Hello and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. The latest episode of the podcast features Chris Hale, Director of Policy at Universities UK. Chris is not a registrar, but is very well placed to talk about registrar-related stuff. We learn about his current role in policy and his career trajectory post-graduation, which saw him fill a number of temporary positions at Sussex University, the General Medical Council, and indeed Universities UK, where he went on to secure a permanent role and has remained ever since. In 20 years at UUK, he's filled most roles, including a brief period acting as Chief Executive. We explore a range of policy issues, including fun with FEC, lobbying over HERA, and sector agency rationalisation. Talking about the changed regulatory environment between Deering and HERA, we discuss the challenges for the OFS, and the impact of all the additional expectations being loaded onto it by government. We also agree on the need for a fresh look at the role of the regulator 5 years on, and for clarity on the future of the designated quality body in England. Finally, we learn about his imminent departure for New Zealand, and note that he's still very much on the lookout for an HE policy job down under. One area Chris intends to explore further is the anthropology of higher education and its acronyms. Very fertile ground for research, and I'm sure we all look forward to future publications in this area. We will all want to wish Chris all the very best in his relocation to New Zealand, I'm sure. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Chris Hale, who's Director of Policy at Universities UK, not technically a registrar, but very much in a registrarial type position, I like to think, in the great institution that is Universities UK. So welcome, Chris. Well, you've got registrar, you know, type characteristics if you're not actually a registrar.
Yeah, no, thanks, Paul. Yeah, I think with this role at Universities UK, we link in with a lot of the professional groups across the sector, and we, you know, I think we rely really quite heavily actually on that sort of professional input we get from registrars and from others in the sector, you know, finance directors and others. So yeah, we touch on a lot of areas, I think.
Yeah, but I think we'll all agree that the registrar's bit is the best bit, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. Wouldn't argue with that at all, no. I'd have left the country by the time this goes out, so.
yeah, you're not going to, no one's going to disagree with that anyway. So, Chris, you're Director of Policy. What does that actually involve at Universities UK?
Yeah, so I oversee a team of about 24 people, 24 FTEs, and we've got policy analysts, we've got policy researchers, we've got policy managers, and I've got a deputy director and assistant director. And what we do really is cover all the areas in higher education on behalf of UK, on behalf of the sector, where we want to be either influencing policy, understanding what's going on, helping the sector understand what's going on, whether it's on funding, research policy, you know, whatever the kind of issue of regulation, whatever the issue of the day is. And we do that for a number of different ways. We will do an analysis, which we then sort of help share with the sector. But we'll also do briefings, which we will feed into our political engagement and engagement with officials and other people that will sort of help inform and shape. And then we'll also sort of do the work that underpins some of the campaigns that UK do and some of that more public facing stuff, which sort of explains what the university sector is doing, you know, and some of that myth busting stuff as well. So we do, you know, we're a small team and we cover all of those areas in higher education that you'd probably expect us to be covering. But and it's a really great team, you know, really high performing team and huge, deep knowledge as well.
So you've been at UUK for 20 years, haven't you? You've been there long time. So what was your, you know, kind of career journey then that brought you ended up as Director of Policy there?
Yeah, well, I actually started my career after I graduated at University of Sussex. I was working in the, it was just after Deering. I went to university a little bit later. I was about 24. I graduated when I was about 27. I guess I was a mature student. And I got a job at the university when I graduated. It was working on sort of post-Deering stuff, and it was looking at how the institution would respond to Deering. So it was doing research about some of the recommendations that were targeted at institutions. And I was based in the career development sort of area at the university, and like the career services unit And so I'd get access to all these sort of jobs that would come up, you know, because it was a temporary job I was doing there. And I saw this job. It was actually at the General Medical Council, and it was working on policy and research, working for the president. So I applied for it. I got it. I'm still to this day absolutely shocked that I got it, because I got asked all these questions about medical ethics and stuff. I mean, I did a media studies degree. You know, it was quite a sort of it was quite a leap. But I got the job, and it was more about speech writing and briefing. And that's where I think I kind of cut my teeth on the policy side. I was working for the president. I was sort of his bag carrier, speech writer, that kind of thing. And the GMC was going through a really quite rough time, at the time of quite a lot of sort of regulatory scandals around, you know, the Bristol Heart scandals and Alder Hey, the issues around organ retention and those kind of things. And so I got real insights into policy, politics, and it was there that was a temporary job. I was attached to the president when he left. I left. It was about 2 years, I think, I worked for him. But while I was there, I saw the job at UUK. And I thought, oh, well, policy, higher education. And actually, in the GMC, we'd done a bit around medical education, that kind of thing. So, and I came for the interview here for a policy officer 20 years ago. And I still remember walking into Woburn House, and I didn't get the job. but what they did is they phoned me up afterwards and said, well, the person who got the job can't start for 3 months. Do you want to sort of come in and kind of fill in? And,
yeah. That's outrageous. I hope. Did you tell them where to stick it?
Looking back on it, it was a bit cheeky. So I mean, I was unemployed, basically. Oh, yeah. I'd just finished my job at the GMC. So yeah. So I said, yeah, go on then. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. I made myself indispensable, Paul.
Oh, that's pretty impressive in only 3 months. But so you worked in policy in UK then since that day?
Yeah. So I sort of started working. I was working for Sue Borman. You might remember Sue Borman. I don't know. She was a sort of bit of a sector figure back in the day, as it were. And I was working on funding and sort of various things like that. And then my sort of big break, I think, was internally, because although I've been working at UK for 20 years, I've done about five jobs. I think there's probably not many jobs I haven't done in the UK, including the chief executive job. So I sort of moved around. But my big break really was there was a policy advisor role, which was a sort of mid-management kind of leadership policy role. And it was for research policy. And I really threw myself into that. I got that about a couple of years after I'd been at the UK. And that was great. You know, that was I was working on the REF and back then they were developing the 10-year science innovation framework and, you know, really, really interesting stuff. And that's when I sort of got to meet characters like David Sweeney and, you know, those kind of things. We were working on full economic costing and all of that sustainability issue. So it was, I think that was a very enjoyable time at UK. And then I sort of just gradually, you know, promotions came up and opportunities came up. And I guess I worked my way up.
It's not often that people have talked about full economic costing and enjoyable times in the same sentence, Chris. But well.
I thought full economic costing was sort of. I mean, yes, I know there was all sorts of headaches about how you influence it, but it was quite. I thought it was quite enlightened actually. They put all this additional money to kind of more or less do the same thing, but fund it better. I thought that was really quite an enlightened thing. You know, if they're going to put additional money in now, can government want to see, you know, a new shiny building or something. So I thought it felt like the right thing to do at the time.
It was, you're right, a very progressive, a very progressive step. But rarely associated with enjoyment, though, I think So in all these jobs, then, I mean, you touched on at the beginning a number of different current or recent policy areas, and you just touched on a few there. So beyond that kind of research policy landscape experience you just described, are there other areas that really stand out for you as things that, you know, have been particularly challenging or particularly enjoyable or indeed particularly successful, you think, in terms of policy influence during your time at UUK?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. I think there's some things which are kind of more sector facing and some things which are probably more, you know, in terms of influencing government policy. I mean, I think I was just taking up the director role at UUK when HERA came in, and there were lots of discussions about, you know, obviously we had the white paper and, you know, Joe Johnson had particular views at the time, and then we got the bill, and I think we were really quite successful in terms of positioning, I think, the sector to be an influential voice on that. We did all the work around, well, what we think a sort of new regulatory regime should look like, and I think that gave us some skin in the game to be able to be a serious player and have something serious to say. We did we had a group that was chaired by Simon Gaskell, who was at QMUL at the time, he's now chair of the QAA, that sort of came up with a bit of a blueprint, which actually wasn't too far away, I think, from where government were going with some of this. So, I mean, I think there's questions about how some of that has now been implemented in the OFS, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. But I think at the time, I think we were quite successful in setting out what we thought the red lines were around autonomy, how we, you know, we needed to make sure that the new arrangements didn't encroach onto the sector's ability to set standards and all of those kind of things. And I think that was you know, we had the good networks, the contacts across government and in Parliament and in the Lords particularly. I mean, it was a lot of late nights and discussions in the Lords. So I think you know, it wasn't just me. We had a team of people here, and you know, we got our parliamentary relations people and our other policy people, and also drawing that expertise from the sector, actually.
Yeah.
So I think that was a success. I mean, more sector facing, I felt there was a massive challenge with the sort of sector agencies. And, you know, we had the Bell Review, which you may remember. And as you might remember, we had all these sort of agencies that had grown up organically and been funded and then sort of developed their own sort of objectives, and, you know, and that all started to unravel, I think. And the question was, well, what do we do about that? And are these things valuable? And do we, you know, but actually the solution was perhaps, you know, quite challenging, I think, for a lot of those individual agencies involved, because as you will know, we came up with a bit of a blueprint through the Bell Review for how all those agencies might merge, because we found a lot of them were doing kind of similar things. And that was really challenging, actually, because, you know, there were lots of good people, chief executive staff in different organisations that were doing good things, but actually the strategic sort of vision for where it needed to go was slightly different, and we had to sort of bring everyone on board and have all those difficult engagements and discussions. So I think that was probably one of the more challenging things, but it needed doing, because I guess the question was, do we just let it wither on the vine, you know? And I think that's probably what would have happened.
And
I'm not saying that, you know, Advance AG is perfect, and you know, but I think where we ended up with the sector agency and that merger process is probably better, and now we have more sensible discussions actually about how they join up and how they don't overlap or duplicate activities and those kind of things. So
yeah, it definitely feels like a more rational landscape.
I guess we rationalized it, modernized it, and I think it's in a, I mean, I think it's in a good place. I mean, as I said, I think it's not without challenges, but that's always going to be the case, isn't it? You know,
just going back to your comments about HERA, I mean, you mentioned Deering earlier, right? I mean, they're less than 20 years apart, you know, and it's it just feels like a completely different world, doesn't it? You know, Deering versus HERA.
Absolutely. We had a lot of debates about this in the UK, because I think there were some people that said, well, we could probably make the 92 Act work, you know, and that whole sort of hefty type approach. But what was happening is the flows of funding were just shifting, and the ways in which accountability worked were shifting. And we had this regulatory partnership group, which was kind of the fudge that was, you know, keeping it all kind of on the tracks. And lots of people said, well, actually, we need to be careful what we wish for, and, you know, all sorts of risks, you know, involved if we do call for a more kind of clear regulatory regime and a sort of different approach. But I think it was probably the judgment at the time was, well, actually, we probably need to be in on that and shaping it and have a clear view of how that needs to go, because the fudge wasn't really sustainable. Even though, actually, I think instinctively a lot of people felt they liked Hefke, they liked that approach. They felt that was sort of part of the sector fabric, and that it was a big shift, I think. But I think reflecting on it, it probably still was the right thing to do. But as I said earlier, it's not without its challenges. I think in terms of how it's been implemented, I think there are still some issues. And we've got post-legislative scrutiny, and we've got arm's length body review coming up with OFS, where I think there's an opportunity to kind of look at some of those issues.
Yeah. But I it does, it is a very different feel to that, that regulatory environment now to, you know, to, well, 5 years ago, but certainly to 25 years ago. And I think you're right about Hefke. I mean, you know, the there is a sense in which, you know, for all sorts of reasons, it felt like it had come to the end of the road, really.
Yeah.
I think, and it, you know, it, there's no way that you could just spend your time, you know, batting to defend, you know, an organization whose principal focus had been funding.
Yeah.
And argue that, you know, actually it should be more focused on regulation and it could do it differently. And it you know, the fresh start approach was I think inevitable, but how it's panned out doesn't feel entirely comfortable to me. I mean, you know, the sector in England, right, and I think this is an issue for universities and for UK, the sector in England is, you know, is on the whole, I think, not wholly happy with the way that the OFS has over the past 4 years gone about its business.
Yeah.
And whilst, you know, may have been willing to cut it some slack, is now feeling that, you know, hang on a second, you know, is it, you know, is it really like this? And, and to give, you know, Susan Lapworth as new chief executive some credit, I think she does recognise that and is seeking to respond to it.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen the extent to which that mood will change. And I you know, so I think the jury's out on that one. But the I think the bigger issue for universities and for Universities UK is this, you know, consistent or other continual you know, explosion of what was a national system into a more fragmented one. You know, mm-hmm. the divide between England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland has just grown and grown and grown. And, you know, we're going to be in a position where UUK are the only body holding it together.
Yeah.
And that's not what UUK was originally there for.
No, it? That's right. I mean, actually, interestingly, we're having that discussion as part of our strategy development looking forward. We've got a new strategy coming where actually over the last 5 or 6 years, exactly as you've said, we've picked up a lot of the stuff that Hefke used to do that was sort of linking in across the UK and sort of supporting the sector. And we kind of think, is that our role? And we're having to sort of reevaluate and think about some of that. I mean, just on the OFS, I think you're right. I mean, OFS has been in startup mode, I think. And I think where it goes next is a big challenge. I think it's got two challenges. One is, I think, is the bureaucracy and the burden. I think and also the other one, I think, is that, and it's not just OFS, I think, is the challenge here. I think it's government and DfE, that it's getting so much loaded onto it. It's starting to look a bit sort of baggy. You know, it's kind of, well, what's its sort of prime focus? We've got freedom of speech coming in, we've got harassment coming in, we've got, you know, we've got this sort of myriad of registration conditions. And there's a sort of question of sort of where does it stop and how does it keep its focus? And I think it's sort of been shaped in response to a sort of a lot of political imperatives more recently. And that may be legitimate. There may be very legitimate democratic sort of influences by government. And I think HERA builds in a lot of that as well, you know, where government can shape it. But I think there's a broader question about how the OFS as well fits in with what sort of good regulatory standards are, what good public governance is in terms of accountability, transparency, fairness, due process. And I think slightly sort of ironically, the OFS suffers slightly from a sort of slight exceptionalism, that we can do things sort of in a special way. And I think actually the sector is accused of exceptionalism sometimes, but I think actually it feels like it sort of feels sometimes like the OFS is a bit Heath Robinson. And I wonder if the opportunity under this sort of arm's length body review is to sort of perhaps have an independent process to just step back and look at this afresh and say, because it's in all of our interests, I think, to have a strong regulator, because that's something we can hold up as a sector and say, look, you can be reassured that we've got a strong regulator that's doing the right things. And I wonder whether under this arm's length body review could step back and just look at it slightly afresh. So I think that process is a real critical one coming up. I mean, it would be my successor working with Vivian that looks at that. But and I think that's got to be an independent process. I'm not sure whether it can be something that the OFS does. You know, you need someone to just, we had the David Grant review of UKRI, which I thought was a really good process where, you know, he was supportive of UKRI and what it was doing, but actually wasn't shy in pointing out what some of the issues and challenges were. And I wonder whether that sort of process is something that is needed. And it's not saying we don't need the OFS or questioning what it does, or, you know, but I think there's probably, as we move into this next phase, I think there's probably an opportunity here.
I think that's absolutely right, Chris. Yeah. There is a sense in which it's developed momentum as it's become established, but it's not entirely clear that it's moving now in a way that anyone wants or expects it to go. And there's a risk that that momentum continues to grow, and we just end up with an unmanageable and extremely costly architecture for regulation that is just a huge burden on the sector. And not only does it, you know, call into question that, you know, hard fought and entirely justified international reputation for the quality of our education, but also it potentially shackles us in a way which is really unhelpful, because over regulation is diverting, costly, burdensome, and just a distraction. And it really doesn't help universities compete on a global stage, which is what we have to do. But I going back to your point, I mean, I think the issue of that regulatory architecture is really important, because we've got the issues around the designated quality body now, where, you know, the QAA is separating itself from that role in relation to the OFS, and the OFS is, you know, will be effectively have to take that on. But where do we go from there, I think, is a big question. And I think that, you know, it's not entirely clear, again, that the direction of travel is one that anyone who was involved in drafting the original bill, you know, anticipated. So I think you're right. The stepping back and looking at the big picture again is really important.
I think it would benefit everyone. Yeah. I mean, just on the UK coherence point as well, which I think is a really important point that you made about that. I think that's been an issue for a while, obviously, as we've kind of gone through devolution. But I think it's important that we keep a focus on that, particularly as we get these sort of divergence across the different regulatory regimes, different funding regimes. Because I think as a system, as a UK system, we have a lot more in common. And sometimes those differences are played up, aren't they? Which are more sort of technocratic policy kind of differences. Whereas actually, you walk into a university in Scotland or in England, and actually you could probably be guaranteed a sort of, you know, a good high quality experience. So I think there's something about how we talk a bit more about what we have in common rather than what the differences are. And I think, unfortunately, because of the sort of what's going on around quality, as you've said, and the sort of role of the DQB in England, some of the sort of differences and those kind of cleavages across the system have been played up quite a lot. And I just wonder if we need to sort of think a bit more as a sector about what's our narrative about what the value of that UK system is, and what we have in common, because I think we probably do have a lot more in common.
Absolutely. But if there's one thing guaranteed to annoy colleagues in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's everyone making the assumption that, you know, the OFS in England and the DfE in England is the UK, and it absolutely isn't. And we've seen that in many other domains as well. And we, you know, who would have thought it would happen in the sphere of higher education regulation?
Absolutely. And on the DQB, I think you're right. I think inevitably, I think that is going to, you know, at least temporarily, it's going to go in house. I mean, we've set out clearly to government and to OFS that in the long term we need a plan for how it would be re-established independently. I think in the sort of short to medium term, the key priority is to make sure that the OFS is able to explain to us how they're going to, you know, protect autonomy and ensure that they deliver that function in a sort of clear and fair way. And I think that's actually, you know, the onus is on the OFS to explain that now, if they do take that in-house, and how they're going to be sort of transparent and accountable for executing that function in the same way that QA would have been. So I think that there's a sort of medium term and a longer term issue there.
Going back, we talking about some of the big policy issues you've been involved in over the years, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, I mean, given that there are, you know, not quite infinite, but a lot of policy choices you can make or areas to choose to focus on, right? How do you go about deciding which things, you know, UK is really, really going to focus on? Because it's quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yes, it's a really good question, Paul. You know, it's one of those things you don't really necessarily step back. You kind of do it, and you know, I think there's different layers to it. We obviously have a strategy which gives us that sort of overarching guide and gives us those kind of parameters. We've got an absolutely fantastic board, which is made up of VCs, and you know, that's a diverse board from across the sector, England, Scotland, and Wales. And they're sort of like our brain trust, really. And we will sort of work with them to sort of identify what we think some of the priority issues are and what we do about it. And I think I think our board plays a big role. But prior to that, we have, you know, we have quite a lot of networks. I mean, we have a lot of discussions through bodies like AHUA and engagement with yourself and other colleagues in the sector. We talk a lot to our colleagues across the nations. We have sort of networks of people we're sort of drawing from, constantly sort of monitoring and drawing from those engagements about what are the sort of issues. And we're also having that political engagement as well. What are the politicians interested in? What's the next thing they're going to sort of be interested in, or that we need to try and get ahead of and anticipate, or they're going to beat us around the head about? So we're trying to kind of pull all those things together. And then we pull all that together in sort of, you know, program plans for the year. We have our sort of annual operation, but we work very much with our board to shape that. And then things come at us where, you know, we might not have anticipated it, or it's just something that's, you know, come up politically that we have to, you know, we just have to drop everything. And, you know, international students might be an issue or that. I mean, it sounds a bit messy, doesn't it? But I think that's part of the challenge of the job, is you sort of operate in that sort of complexity and uncertainty, and you're trying to sort of say, well, actually, how do we move the sector and get the sector to be as influential as possible, either in response to some of these issues or actually anticipate them and get ahead of it. I mean, one of the issues I've sort of struggled a little bit with at UK, and it has been a challenge, it's been grade inflation, for example. Yeah. And I think the sector, it was clear for quite a long time that the sector was extremely vulnerable to this, you know, whatever the issue was around grade inflation, whatever was, you know, you can argue how you measure it and was it actually happening, but politically it was an issue. And it was feeding this kind of negative perception of the sector, you know, in the Telegraph, the Mail, you know, standards are slipping, we're going to hell in a handcart, you know, people are coming out of university, you can't be guaranteed what they've achieved, what they say they're going to achieve. And I think we've tried to sort of position the sector to kind of get on top of that one and be more proactive and say, well, actually, we as a sector, we take this issue seriously. We don't necessarily agree with your criticisms, but we take it seriously. And I think that's a good example of how over the years we've sort of positioned and manoeuvred UK to perhaps have a more of a proactive voice on some of those issues and challenges.
Yeah. And I have to say, I think over time, you know, I think you've picked the right things on the whole, and also picked areas where UK is kind of uniquely placed to be the most positive intervention. I mean, the issues around international students in particular strike me as the, you know, the most effective area that UK has demonstrated, you know, in the past decade, possibly. And because it is so important to both individual institutions, the sector, and indeed, you know, the national economy, right? You know, you couldn't afford to fail. But it's kind of worked, but it doesn't go away, right? And, you know, there's always a new angle. There's always, you know, some other minister flying a kite, isn't there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'd agree. I sort of see internally the amount of work and effort that goes into that, the political lobbying, the briefings, the engagement, the analysis, the policy work, you know, it's been a significant focus and priority. But I think we have to balance some of that. I guess it comes back to that point I was making about grade inflation. Sometimes I think we have to get the balance between that reactive work. I agree, we absolutely have to work on that, and we will always put resource in that, against trying to sort of think what are the things that, because what VCs worry about is the sector's on the back foot and that we're criticized and there's these negative perceptions. And I think we have to try and sort of identify those areas where we're vulnerable, you know, where the sector is seen to be vulnerable around, you know, like, you know, standards and quality, I think, you know, and where government and others will start poking us and poking sticks and saying, well, actually, you know, we've seen that whole debate about low value, for example.
I
think we were probably a little bit late reacting to that. I think we were in a better place than we were. But we need to, you know, and I think that sort of broader strategic kind of question around quality, how we demonstrate that, how we promote that is going to be a really important one over the coming years as well. So is that balance, I think, between fighting the hand-to-hand combat with the Home Office and trying to sort of manage these other bigger kind of issues?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of putting it. Anyway, you're abandoning all of that, aren't you? And leaving this exciting policy landscape that you've been part of for 20 years to go to New Zealand. You know, what's that all about then?
I mean, I've loved working at UUK. I've been here for 20 years. I wouldn't have been here at 20 years if I hadn't loved it. And people are brilliant. And I've got to work with, I mean, I've worked with Vivian Stern for 20 years. We sort of started more or less the same time. And, you know, Vivian's absolutely fantastic and a great colleague. But I, my partner is a Kiwi. She's been in London for 20 years. And we met about 15 years ago. When we met, there was a sort of, it wasn't quite a deal, but there was an agreement that, you know,
sounds like Blair and Brown, this does.
there was an agreement that we would go to live near her family. And I think, you know, my kids are at that age where, I mean, my oldest just about starts GCSEs. And I think if we don't do it now, we probably won't do it at all. And also coming out of the pandemic, I think we sort of, you know, reevaluated being near family. I don't really have much family left in England anymore. So it sort of felt like the right time to do it. Yeah. And because it's very much a family driven decision. So we've both kind of, I mean, it's quite risky, but we're both giving up our jobs and relocating. So when I get there, I don't have a role to go to. If anyone's listening in New Zealand in higher education policy, you know, do call me. But I've made some, I mean, people in the sector have been very generous with their contacts, and I've had a lot of late night calls with people in New Zealand before Christmas and more recently. So I'm starting to sort of get to know the place and get to know the people and the higher. Ideally, I'd like to kind of work in higher education in some shape or form over there. But you know, I think that policy role gives you insights into other sectors and you know, so. So yeah, that's really what's driving it, and well, I'm quite excited about it actually.
It sounds like a real adventure. I'm sure you will find something productive and policy related to do. I mean, it's, you know, that whole area, both New Zealand and wider Australasia, is you know, really interesting policy landscape, I think. So I'm sure you'll find something. Finally, then, Chris, before you go. You know, you've seen a lot in your time in higher education. Is there something that you'd pick out as, you know, particularly interesting or surprising or shocking or amusing during your time that you could share with us?
There's probably been lots of sort of shocking things and amusing things, and some of it I probably shouldn't talk about. I mean, one of the things that's amused me throughout the time I've been at higher education is the whole sort of way in which it's the sort of anthropology of higher education and its relationship with acronyms. And I mean, aside from finding it quite impenetrable when I first started, I've noticed over the years there's a whole sort of culture and subculture and series of conventions around it. And I know Wonky and others have had some fun around this, particularly around how you pronounce things like Hefsi, is it Hefki or Hefsi and that kind of thing. But a few observations from me. You've got your sort of primary acronyms, you've got your, you know, they're top of the pile. You've got sort of your Hefki, I know they're defunct now, but people still talk about them, your OFSs, your UKRIs. Yeah, even UUK actually, where you never really mention the original name, and also you talk about them as if they're a person. You know, they've got their own personality, their own traits, their own flaws, and everyone sort of knows from the way you talk about them what that means. And then you've got then another observation, you've got those who are setting up new groups or new organisations who sort of try and engineer an acronym to spell out something that's sort of vaguely related or signalling what the group is doing. And I sort of admire that. I think that shows quite a strong commitment. But my favourites are the quality folk. They love their acronyms, but they don't really seem to worry about sort of spelling out anything. And particularly when you get into Europe, you get this sort of string of A's and Q's and E's and L's and U's, and you know, you can never really cut, and they're all sort of slightly interchangeable. You never really quite know what body you're talking about. I've got very lost and made some quite sort of big errors in that area in the past. And I think there's, my theory is there's some sort of random sort of quality body acronym generator that only sort of someone like Douglas Blackstock has the password to. But lastly, I think the worst are the SAGs and the SACs. And then obviously SAG is Strategic Advisory Group, but I think it's very difficult to find a word that conveys strategy less than the word SAG. And then the Strategic Advisory Committees, I think, or SAC, I think whatever letters you put in front of it, it's going to sound a bit rude, and you're going to have a bit of a giggle about it. And I've had my own struggles with this. We had a group called the Social Mobility Advisory Group, which was SMAG, and I tried my hardest. I spent ages trying to stop people calling it the SMAG, but it just stuck. And in the end, I just called it SMAG. You know, I just kind of went with it. So. There are just a few observations on the sort of my own sort of, anthropology. I might write a book when I get to New Zealand, the sort of anthropology of acronym usage in UK higher education.
Well, and then you'll be able to compare it with Australasian. No, really fascinating. I could completely agree. But that's a really good take on it. And I'm absolutely on board with you. I've seen some real shockers. Over the years, and I would add another subculture within that, which is, yeah, I mean, you talked about the quality people working in particularly the area of kind of learning and teaching enhancement as well, are very very focused on coming up with something that sounds important and good and novel and interesting, right? And going back to our Hefke time, the whole the investment in what were they called, Kettle, the centers
yeah,
for
yeah,
excellence
I,
and teaching,
yeah, I remember those,
and there were something like 90 of them around England, but some of the names for them and the acronyms used were just extraordinary, because everyone had to come up with a new acronym, you know.
Yeah, that's
and
it,
I think that was a golden age of acronym creation. And of course, I mean, Sussex was pretty good at acronyms. Not quite as good as UEA though, because obviously UEA had an acronym for its name, you know.
Yeah,
and every school at UEA had an acronym. And one of my enormous sources of pride is coming up with an acronym for a new school at UEA, which it doesn't exist anymore, but it did for a decade. So I was very proud to have foisted an acronym onto a university.
The other thing, just quickly, is that sometimes you get these acronyms, but people they actually forget what they stand for, or they have different interpretations. So I remember the Social Mobility Advisory Group, which I mentioned.
Yeah.
Some people would call it the Social Mobility Action Group. And in the end, I couldn't remember. I was thinking about it earlier ahead of this podcast. I was like, was it the Social Mobility Action Group, or was it the Advisory Group? So I think they become detached from their original sort of meaning. It's
I very fertile ground for your research, Chris. Well, listen, we need to stop there, but thank you so much for your time, and thanks for everything that you've done in your time at UUK. And I'm sure others will want to wish you, as will I, all the very best for your future in New Zealand. And I hope that we will still hear from you and your productive research on acronyms in the future. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks, Paul. I will be watching fondly from afar.
that's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.